Okay, and what kind of, I mean, you said that it was kind of the typical response of what people would say, but just to be more specific, I guess, what kinds of things were said to you? You know, was this in San Francisco? Was this in other places along the way?
Well, at the I came back from Vietnam essentially end of January, beginning of February of 69.
Mm-hmm.
There were a fair number of demonstrations going on around. Whether the people who made comments to me in San Francisco at the airport when I was getting ready to fly cross country, I don't know whether they were part of a organized demonstration.
Mm-hmm.
They just simply have been there
uh-huh.
and voiced their individual opinion. The comments, there were people who spat near me and who made the comments about the baby killers. Those are the only two distinct things that I remember.
Mm-hmm.
There may have been other things and stuff at the time, and basically I just turned and walked away. I certainly did not end up in any kind of physical, argumentative, verbal confrontation of any kind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When I got to D.C., I was only in D.C. overnight, but there were demonstrations going on, you know, in the D.C. area that I read about in the paper and saw in the news. I was not a part of those, and then, of course, the longer that I was home after Vietnam, the more I saw that on the news and the like. I never personally had a confrontation. I'm not the kind of person who would have, who, having seen a demonstration, would go out and confront those people and exacerbate the situation. I would be more apt to just turn around and let them do their own thing and then go my own way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see any purpose to asking for trouble, but clearly nobody confronted me either except for that situation in the airport in California.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they knew. I mean, people who wanted to demonstrate against the troops, almost everybody coming back from Vietnam was going to be coming into Oakland and then having to fly out of the commercial airport in San Francisco. So if you want to demonstrate against those troops, they're going to be easy to identify. You get out of the airport, you can pick, you know, take your pick of the lot as to who you want to pick on.
Right.
But I did not really have other than that experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so when you came home, you said you came home once you got to New Hampshire. Your daughter was 11 months old at the time?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so how was getting adjusted back to a life and all of a sudden a child?
It's hard to answer that question because I don't know what other options would have been like.
Mm-hmm.
My personal feeling is that it was at the time and still is today that it was probably better that I'd gone to Nam when I did than to have delayed it by asking for deferment.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it made any significant impact on the relationship with my daughter, but I don't know that it couldn't have been better if I'd done something else.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that we, as far as I know, we've not had those kinds of major problems and stuff. I mean, we certainly have had our disagreements at times, but she's getting married in October, and
mm-hmm.
everything is still copacetic between us.
Uh-huh.
But I can't say that it made a significant impact. Again, I think that at that time, the fact that I was home and that we were going to be relocating and being a family again was probably a little bit better and easier on my wife. It wasn't until my son's situation and what I described a little bit ago that we ended up in that really terrible period that I think we really grew in our ability to cope with adverse circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
After that, I think it was a very maturing experience, but at that point, at the time that I came back from Vietnam, it was just, you know, kind of good to be home, and everything looked like it was clearer, better, brighter for the future, and I don't think that there were any negative aspects that I can remember.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what was that like being away at that, I guess, not just being away from family and wife in general, but at that point too? And how did you cope with that? Was it just mainly writing or talking when possible?
We exchanged pretty much daily mail, unless I try it. Mm-hmm. The other thing was, I don't know if you remember in those days, but one of the hot technical items was these little small recorders, voice recorders, that had kind of a little reel-to-reel thing. You could put them in a mailer and send them off. So we exchanged a fair number of those as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think coping under those circumstances was difficult. Interestingly enough, when I first went to Vietnam, because I was so busy right from the get-go for those first several weeks, I didn't really have the opportunity to get lonely or to think about my situation.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until after the post-Tet Offensive that those kinds of feelings occurred. I think at times, sure, I mean, you get to the point where you feel out of touch and somewhat alienated from friends and family, no matter how you feel about them. But I can't say that there were really major kinds of difficulties or problems.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had anticipated some of those. I knew what I was going, what it was going to be like for a year. I knew it was time limited. I think that's a positive. Those people, for example, in World War II, who went off to war and didn't return for 5 years, had a very much different situation than those of us who are in Vietnam, and even today, were, even with extensions, mm-hmm. not going there for an interminable period of time. You knew your year was going to be up. It was, I'm sure you've probably heard the expression from some of the other people you've interviewed about setting up short-termers calendars.
Mm-hmm.
People would set up these calendars and mark off the days and stuff. And that's good, although I will tell you that one of my experiences in Vietnam was, and I think the statistics bear this out, is that people who got killed or maimed often got killed or maimed in their first few weeks or in their last few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Their first few weeks because they didn't know any better and they did stupid things. In their last few weeks because they thought they had become invincible and they were going to get out unscathed. In fact, one of my best friends from growing up in grammar school was part of a group of five people from a reserve unit in New Hampshire. They were all killed on the last day. They were actually on their way back to Saigon to fly out to come home when they hit a landmine and were all killed.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that that's a very typical kind of pattern. I worried about that in my last few months. I figured, I got through this far. I don't want to be having a problem now. So I think there were some of us who played it ultra safe in those last couple of months. But a large number of people get careless in those, especially in some of the combat troops. I recall one particular individual that I took care of who was making his last tour in a Jeep, a perimeter security tour with his replacement, and he was then going to be flying home. Again, they hit a landmine. He ended up losing both of his legs. That's the kind of thing that I think happens too often because people tend to let their guards down. I try not to do that, but clearly there's always the risk that you're going to be injured in those circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And were there other particularly memorable instances or patients or days or events?
They are, but they're... It's hard to... I can remember a couple of you probably watched the movie MASH over.
Mm-hmm.
I think everybody's experiences tend to run a gamut. There are clearly experiences that are really very tragic. The two that probably stick out most in my mind, three actually, there was a situation where one day I ended up doing anesthesia for six different people, all of whom were basically having craniotomies or back surgery. All of them ended up with either paraplegia or quadriplegia because of their injuries.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty devastating. That's the only time in that year in Vietnam that I can remember going out and saying, why am I here? Didn't do very much for myself.
Mm-hmm.
The tragedy, it was really that. another, on the negative side, was one day where we had four patients in adjoining beds. They were two on one side, two on the other, in the recovery room unit, all of whom had fat emboli. I don't know if you're familiar with fat emboli.
No.
You have fractures of long bones. The fat in the bones get into the bloodstream and go to the brain or heart or lungs. All of those four guys were dead within 2 hours of that time. Again, kind of depressing. That gets to be a tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
On the other end of the spectrum, there was one day that there was not very much going on. In fact, there was nothing going on. And there hadn't been anything going on for a couple of days, and so people started getting rambunctious. And we had a mouse in the OR, and somebody captured the mouse, and they decided, it wasn't me, I wasn't involved with this, but a good friend of mine was, and they decided they were going to operate on the mouse. So between a surgeon and an anesthetist, they anesthetized the mouse and operated on the mouse.
And exactly what kind of surgery was performed?
It was abdominal bowel surgery on the mouse. Unfortunately, the mouse died, but...
oh, my goodness.
It was the kind of thing that, when I heard about it, I went over to the OR too and stuff. And by then, the mouse had already died. But people were obviously just bored and looking to do something to raise hell. Could you criticize it? Sure. But again, I think it was not seen as being way out of touch.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, the mouse was a problem for the operating room. Those kinds of things, people needed to get rid of the mouse anyways, and they were able to capture them, and they went ahead and did this, which was probably not right. there's a whole lot of little different specific memories like that. Like you said, the one with the four kids, or six kids who operated, that we operated on that were left quadriplegic, that was really a tragedy. One of the other things that I saw that was really very difficult was when an anesthesiologist had to make a determination about a kid who was quadriplegic, who was very likely to die, and ended up having to take him off the ventilator because somebody else needed the ventilator more.
Mm-hmm.
That's really tragedy to see somebody die for that reason. And that was a difficult thing to watch, but I couldn't argue. I mean, philosophically, ethically, that it wasn't the right thing to do. It was somebody else needed it more and was more likely to survive. But it's a tough decision that I wish nobody had to make in this particular case.
All right. Hmm. And did you find at any point that because you were a male nurse that you were given different assignments?
No, I can't say that. I think that's a function of the anesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
I can't speak for those people who worked on the ward, although I'm not aware that there were any assignment differences based on gender. In the operating room, at least in terms of the anesthesia, there never was, not in Vietnam or any place else that I've ever been. It just has not happened. The only difference that I have seen over time was that there was a time when it was pretty classical. The surgeon would be a male, I would be the anesthetist, and everybody else would be female.
Mm-hmm.
I increasingly in the last few years have been in situations where it was female surgeon, female assistant, female circulators, female scrub nurse, and me. And I've been the odd man out.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's just a reflection of how gender equality issues have swung things around in terms of opportunities for a lot of women.
Mm-hmm. And how did all of that play out in the military with the women's movements and the gender equality?
There are those who say that the Army or the military is America's greatest social experiment. And it is. I have to say that you'll remember back in the 60s, mid-60s, that the military came under a lot of criticism for its race issues.
Mm-hmm.
And those race issues have been around at least since World War II. But after 1965, Rights Act, there clearly were big pushes to try to provide some kind of equality. And the Army changed its procedures and tried to change people's attitudes in a positive way. And I think probably faster than most of the other segment of America, they were able to provide equal opportunity for blacks and for minority groups, much more so than anybody in the civilian sector. I think that happened with gender equality as well, and probably even more readily in the healthcare area. When you're talking about healthcare in the military, as opposed to probably most other job areas, the healthcare people in the military differ only in that they end up putting a uniform on to go to work. In terms of our day-to-day relationships, in terms of what we do on a day-to-day basis, it's pretty much as exactly what we would do in the civilian sector.
Mm-hmm.
That may not be true for the banker or the baker or somebody else, but I can tell you that at least for healthcare, the relationships and the I think in part because of the educational and experiential background of healthcare providers, there really isn't a big difference. And I think that that was true for healthcare with regards to gender equality. The women were treated much better earlier in military and healthcare. Even today, they command a big share of the command and responsibility. Did they work their way to the top quickly? No. That happened over time. When I first went in, it had been all females who had been chiefs of the Corps, chief of the Army Nurse Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And we speculated as to whether a guy would ever get it. Nobody would, you know, thought it was going to happen in their lifetime. But General Bill Bester, who was one of my former nurse anesthesia students, just retired as chief of the Army Nurse Corps. He was the first guy. And I think that says as much as to gender equality within the Army Nurse Corps as anything.
Mm-hmm.
It was really, it has always been in nursing, a question of whether there was a possibility of reverse discrimination. And there were clearly a lot of guys who thought that there was. And I think Bill's experience has been that it doesn't have to be, it isn't, that everybody has an equal chance of making it to the top.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to write down notes, too, as the things I think of as I go along, so not all of these fit a chronological or a or a thought pattern here. But one thing I wanted to ask you about was Mary Powell's book that recently came out, A World of Hurt. I wanted to know if you had seen that or read that. She was a nurse.
Sorry, I don't know. What's the name of the title again?
A World of Hurt.
No.
She was a nurse at the 24th Evac. Okay. What about any of the other books by or about nurses in Vietnam?
Not in Vietnam per se. No, I've read some on you know the Bataan nurses and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. But not any of you know, the Home Before Morning or any of those.
I've heard of some of them.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've generally had book reviews and things like Army Times or.
Uh-huh.
Some of the other areas or some of the nursing journals.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what about the memorial in D.C., the women's memorial that was put in?
Yeah.
And kind of the debate or question of if that was the nurse's memorial or the women's memorial. yes, what did you think about that and all of that movement?
I have some mixed feelings about that. The gal or one of the prime movers for that is Dee Lipman, who is professor here at one of the nursing schools in the Bridgeport area, and also currently the president of the Connecticut Nurses Association. And she was a backer of the memorial right from the get-go. I have no problem with it, and I've seen the statue and stuff. There are those who obviously contend that there should have been some men included in the nurses' memorial. But again, it depends on how you define it, whether it's
mm-hmm.
the memorial or the women's memorial.
Uh-huh.
But I don't have any really strong feelings one way or the other. I have some general feelings that while everybody deserves some attention, I think we're getting to the point where perhaps we're having too many memorials in the D.C. area to different groups, and maybe some of that ought to be consolidated, but others feel differently.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so what, let's say, I guess you came back from Vietnam and you said you had had different training and different, different number of years, but what was it that made you stay in the military or decide to make that a career?
Well, like you say, after I had two or three tours, I got to like the military. I saw it as an area that had a lot of potential for upward mobility, for opportunities that I wasn't apt to find in the civilian sector. One of the biggies that I think people tend to underestimate, but which I think is particularly true for the nurse anesthetist, is the latitude of scope of practice. I remember I said earlier that one of the things that was particularly unique about Vietnam was that everybody in healthcare got to move up a notch. I think that has always been true of the military, the latitude of practice for nurses, doctors, and what have you, tends to be much broader than it generally is in the civilian sector. There are some legitimate reasons for those, legitimate reasons for that. One of them, of course, being the difference in liability, but also simply because it's a function of necessity, that there are oftentimes in the military setting not enough people to do all the jobs, so everybody has to kind of share in and do stuff that somebody can pick up on something that somebody in the civilian sector, somebody else in the civilian sector might have to do. So, for example, things that I would not normally do in the civilian sector, like put in chest tubes, etc., are things that I got to do in Vietnam that I think, and I think most healthcare people will tell you, broaden their scope and broaden their ability, their self-confidence, their level of self-esteem as a professional, etc., that I think played a positive role and I think has generally had a positive impact post-Vietnam in the healthcare sector. I mentioned the development of medics and paramedics and PAs and other groups that really kind of all stemmed out of that Vietnam experience. Because people have had the opportunity to do things they would not otherwise have had, and who found that they enjoyed that kind of work and suddenly found an interest in committing to it as a life's work. And I think that that has paid very positive dividends. You can look at that in a lot of different areas. I mean, one of the real biggies that revolutionized healthcare in America was the medical evacuation helicopter. It had been around in Korea, but it was never used to the same extent it was after Vietnam. And it's become, you know, almost a de rigueur. Every metropolitan area of the country now has some kind of medical helicopter evacuation service on the civilian sector. It's made a big difference in saving people's lives.
And it seems that you've been very involved with the profession in general, too. You're vice president of the AANA, is that right? Are you finishing up your...
I have not run for this year for president-elect, so my term of office will be up in a couple of weeks. Yeah, I've always been involved with state and national associations, not only AANA, but the American Association of Nurse Attorneys chapter here in Connecticut, the Connecticut Nurses Association, the Connecticut Nurses Political Action Committee. I'm on the GRC, the Government Relations Committee, for both the Connecticut Association of Nurse Anesthetists and the Connecticut Nurses Association. So yeah, I've been involved.
And is your wife still, did she practice as a nurse later?
Oh, yeah, my wife's full-time employee. She's in long-term care. Currently, she's the assistant administrator of a nursing home down in Stamford, Connecticut. She's previously served as a director of nursing in that area. She's done some oncology nursing. She's done pediatric nursing. She's done some general duty stuff. But for the last 10 or more years, she's been heavily involved in long-term care, first as director of nursing, and then as a consultant and as a corporate compliant, corporate operations person, and now as the assistant administrator. She earned her administrator's license last year, and when they ended up restructuring her facility, she ended up with the position of assistant administrator, so that's what she's doing now.
And what, or I guess she didn't join the Army, and military nursing wasn't what she did. I guess what was the difference?
What was the difference? My wife probably would have considered that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we did consider it, but the laws didn't allow for that in those days.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, they generally would not look favorably on a husband and wife team being members of the Army Nurse Corps, and the law specifically excluded you if you got pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And so my wife was childbearing age, so she would have been in and out quite quickly, I suspect. That just didn't seem possible. But,
uh-huh.
So she has continued to work in the civilian sector throughout.
Uh-huh.
She did consider it. By the time they changed the rules, it was not entirely out of the picture, but she was well enough along in years that it would have, she'd still be in, for example, right now to complete a 20-year career.
Mm-hmm.
And she felt she didn't want to do that at that point. But early on, it just wasn't feasible because of the laws.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And are you happy with the way things have gone, your career and the military and the year abroad and all of that?
Yep. I also served abroad in Europe for 3 years.
Oh, uh-huh.
My military career. I think overall it's worked out reasonably well. I mean, there are ups and downs. There are some things that I guess I regret. Some other things that I don't regret. But you can't go back. And I think one of the things that has distinguished my wife and I over the years is that we've always been people that we try to consider all the possibilities, and once we make a decision, even if it's a difficult decision, we don't look back. Because
mm-hmm.
I don't think that really gains you anything.
Mm-hmm.
So it's generally decisions that we've been pretty happy with over the years. We don't know what the future holds, but hopefully we'll continue.
And so once you came back from Vietnam, and then I guess where were you stationed after that? After your
when I came back from Vietnam, I was assigned to Aberdeen Proving Ground, Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there for a year and a half, and then that's when I put in for long-term civilian schooling to go back and get my bachelor's. That was at the point in time that right after I was accepted for that and was getting ready to be reassigned. That my wife started having problems with pregnancy, and that we get into that downward spiral for several years.
Mm-hmm.
But we managed to get through it. It was not easy. It was a very difficult time for us. And I suspect that everybody in their lives gets through a period of similar difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
We've never had anything quite like it since then, but it just seemed for a while that everything that we decided or touched or did just turned to doo-doo. And it took us a while to turn that around.
Mm-hmm.
But once it did, things have generally been pretty good.
Mm-hmm. And so you got your BA through the civilian schooling, and then I saw in your email, I think you have an MA as well.
MED. Okay. I got the MED when after I went back to school from Aberdeen Proving Grounds, I went back home to St. Anselm College, where I earned my BSN. At that time, I could do that in an accelerated framework based on the prior college stuff that I'd already done.
Mm-hmm.
That was going to be changing, but I was able to get in. I finished by, actually, December of 71. I was credited with a 72 graduation date, and then was reassigned to Europe. I was in Munich for about 10 months till the end of the 72 Munich Olympics, and then was assigned to Heidelberg. I was at that point interested in eventually teaching in a nursing anesthesia program in the military. To do that, I needed a graduate degree, and Boston University had its education program available in the area of Heidelberg, Stuttgart, and I took courses there and finished in 74. It's essentially the same program that was offered here on the Boston campus. I finished that in 74 and then came back to I came back to the United States in January 75. I went to what is called the Officer's Advanced Course, which is at that time 6 months long. And after that, I was reassigned to a teaching position. at El Paso at William Bauman Army Medical Center. I was there doing didactic teaching for the first couple of years, then got involved in some other stuff, and then later went on to become a program director there, and was later reassigned to Tacoma, Washington, the Madigan Army Medical Center, and that's where I retired in 1984.
Mm-hmm. And then somehow, 20 years later, you're back on the other side of the continent.
Well, we were in Tacoma for, I guess, a total of about 12 years. I graduated in 84, and in 1990, I was at that time doing straight clinical, wanting to get back into teaching, and the job that was open was here in Bridgeport.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I ended up here. Plus, my wife and I wanted to come back to the East Coast because her folks were getting along in years, and we thought their health might deteriorate, and we wanted to be back here. So it seemed like a good opportunity. Well, her folks are still trucking along. They're in great health, and we're still here. I'm looking to probably get back into teaching if I can here in the next little bit, but I'm also looking at some other things. So.
Mm-hmm. So you're technically retired, but you're still pretty busy.
Only in the sense of being retired from the Army. In fact, I tell people that I plan to work till I'm 75, but everybody thinks I'm joking, but I'm not. If my health holds up, I'd like to be able to say that I spent 50 years as a CRNA, and that means I'd have to work till I'm 74 or 75. And whether that'll be feasible or not, I don't know. I can tell you that there are other aspirations to my life that I would hope to fulfill before I retire, so I'm not about to hang up the hat just yet.
Wow, well, I really appreciate it. I think we've been through pretty much everything. Was there something that we didn't talk about that...
I can't think of anything. I guess I guess the only thing that I would kind of clarify is kind of what is the basic theme of your research? What kind of focus are you looking at? Are you just trying to provide a broad picture of what the guys who were nurses in Vietnam were like, or is there a more specific focus?
Well, part of what I'm doing, I'm from a history background. I'm not a nurse. I'm not from a military family or background anyway. So I'm kind of approaching this from a historical standpoint, and I'm trying to see kind of how the military is changing in the time and, you know, related that to the, you know, more male nurses coming into the profession, the women's movements, the war, and kind of how all of that plays together and changes nursing in the military. So that's kind of what I'm trying to do, trying to look at it from a lot of different angles with recruitment and you know, the different ways that men nurses were used or women nurses, or if that happened, you know, all kinds of different questions, portrayal of nurses, that sort of thing.
So that's an interesting area. If you start, there have been a couple of good articles that have been published about the image of nursing in the media and things like television and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting topic of itself. But in terms of specifically of men, I mentioned that when I went in, it was only about 1%. Now it's about 8%. I think you'll notice that there has been a big paradigm shift with regards to male nurses in the last, probably 5 or 6 years. And it probably hasn't been so dependent on the military, although the earlier shift in terms of providing some gender equality for guys was probably the military. First, male nurses. Male nurses have always served in the military,
mm-hmm.
but they were not officers. They weren't recognized as Army Nurse Corps officers until 1956. And as a matter of fact, you talked about Bill Story, but the guy who's going to, in 2 weeks now, be the president of the ANA was one of my instructors at Walter Reed. He was the second Army Nurse Corps male officer commissioned,
uh-huh.
Frank Maziarski. There's a very excellent video you might want to get, and you can get it from the American Association of Nurse Anesthetists on nursing's 100-year history with the Army. Army Nurse Anesthetists is the focus. But it's a great film. It runs about 20 minutes, and it's still available. It would give you a lot of insights, and the number of the people who are in there are people that you probably have talked to or that would be known to you or accessible to you.
Mm-hmm.
In the post-Vietnam period, I think the impact of the military made a big difference. However, the shift that is occurring now is occurring for different reasons. If you look at the sudden rise in the number of male nurses nationwide in the last 5 or 6 years, the primary driving force is the socioeconomic changes. There are a lot of people who lost their jobs in the recession that lasted through till about, well, just this past year or so. During that time, there were people, a large number of guys in particular, faced with having to relocate to a second, third, or fourth career. And that has created a large influx of the number of guys attending nursing programs, in part because of the idea that they bought into that it's a stable occupation, that if they finish, they will at least always have a job. Now, that's not an uncommon thought in nursing. It's been around for a long time. But I think more guys are buying into it. And so you've seen a very rapid influx here from 4 to 8% in terms of the number of male nurses in just the last half dozen years or so. And I suspect you've probably already been in touch with the American Nurses Association for some of the statistics on those numbers. That would be very useful to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the only question I can think of.
Okay. Great, let me end the interview and then I'll explain the forms and things that I'm going to send to you.